The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Wednesday, August 29th, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Why to tape, ladies and gentlemen? Because this is one of our famous on vacation, but not really on vacation shows. We're not live, per se, as far as you know. But we do have an all-new interview today. Quinn Slobodian, author of Globalists, The End of Empire and the Birth of Neoliberalism. A fascinating look into how those guys, when they gathered, and I do mean guys, when they gathered at Mont Pelerin, their plan was not just for infecting their neoliberal prescription in their various domestic contexts, but how do they prevent global institutions, or I should say, sovereignty of nation states to interfere with global institutions projecting neoliberalism on the international sphere. Interesting, you know, the words neoliberalism gets thrown around quite a bit. And I think it actually does mean something specific and very often not necessarily what many people think it does. But this is a look that, you know, if you and I think during the course of this interview, Slobodian says that he either worked with Philip Murawski, who we've had on here, and I think his book was Never Let a Good Crisis Go to Waste or something to that effect, about the birth of neoliberalism in that era in Mount Pelerin. So this is going to be interesting stuff for you folks. And, you know, we've got, you know, more interesting interviews this week. Emily Ogden will be here tomorrow with a slice of American history that you are not aware of that is has big implications for arguments about racism today and the way you see it projected. I mean, as I say this, I'm specifically thinking about that Charlie Kirk and Jordan Peterson interview. But we'll talk about that tomorrow when we introduce it then. And members today will get another one of those famous Matt picks, the deep archives. This could go deep. It could be part of, like, you know, this tenure of this show. I mean, now we're an episode probably around, I think, like 1905 or something like that.
Past that.
Are we?
We're at like 1909 or 10 right now.
That's nuts. And so we could go back and find something in this show, or we could go to deep, deep archives, which is, you know, back in the original Majority Report days on Air America. So stick around if you're a member for that and check that out. And a reminder, to become a member of this program, to support it daily in and out, because even on vacation, we get new shows. I mean, I think like there's probably like 4 days a year maybe that we do best of, right? Like that last week of January, of December. But beyond that, we give you a new show every single
day. Often we save the best or some of the best interviews for times you can pre-record them and have more time to stretch out with them.
Exactly. So this stuff gets pretty meaty and interesting and dynamic. So sit back, enjoy this. Just remember, if you want to support this program, go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. We say thank you by giving you some extra content. It's a couple of dimes a day. Also, don't forget, this program is sponsored by BetterHelp.com. You can go to betterhelp.com/majority. You get unlimited access to a licensed, trained, fully accredited therapist. Perfect for you. They're LGBT friendly. They're good for couples counseling. You always have access to these folks. You call them on the phone. You go call via your computer. literally you could talk to them every day. And if you have a therapist that you hook up with through the questionnaire that you don't like after a while, no problem. You get another one. A lot of reasons why people prefer to get their therapy delivered this way, whether it's just the first time for you in therapy or you just can't afford therapy that is in office, BetterHelp.com/majority. All right, quick break. When we come back, Quinn Slobodian on Globalists, the End of Empire and the Birth of Neoliberalism. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome right now from Berlin, Quinn Slobodian. He is an associate professor of history at Wellesley College and the author of Globalists, The End of Empire and the Birth of Neoliberalism. Welcome to the program, Quinn.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So let's start with the term neoliberalism. Whenever I interview anybody who's written anything about neoliberalism, I ask for a definition. There's a lot of very casual misuse of the word, and it your book is an intellectual history of sorts, and specific in some respects to global institutions and global trade. But tell us, broadly speaking, what is neoliberalism?
Well, I think a lot of the confusion comes from the fact that it's used often in three very distinct ways. One is to designate a period of time, sort of starting in the 1970s and then accelerating with the period of Thatcher and Reagan, characterized by union busting and austerity and privatization. So it's a way people talk about the most recent 40 years of history. A second way it's used is to describe a kind of new and accelerated version of capitalism that is somehow qualitatively different from what preceded it. So people talk about how we are all now entrepreneurs of ourselves, or we are containers of human capital that need to be appreciated and caretaken over time. So there's this idea that it's something, even an exaggerated form of capitalism, that has begun to embrace every aspect of human existence in a way that it hadn't before. So that the second way it's used. The way that I use it in my book, another way that it's used, is to describe a pretty discreet intellectual movement of people who actually coined the term neoliberalism themselves in 1938 to describe the political project that they were pursuing, which was one that saw capitalism as in need of constant caretaking by a strong state. So the market wouldn't take care of itself. The market needed to be constantly protected and cared for, and markets themselves needed to be safeguarded through new institutions that would prevent democratic majorities from disrupting them. And that intellectual movement is associated with some names that people might have heard, like Friedrich Hayek, Milton Friedman. And it was organized around something, and is organized around something called the Mont Pelerin Society. And the way that I approach the question of neoliberalism is the same as someone like the philosopher Michel Foucault did, which is to say, to try to enter the world, the thought worlds of these particular thinkers, as a way to understand some of the internal logics of the forms of government and forms of markets and capitalism that we see around us.
And I mean, are we able, I mean, just for this, the sake of where we're headed, are we able to see, like, is it possible to draw a line from what was discussed initially at Mont Pelerin and then ultimately, you know, in an ongoing fashion through the Mont Pelerin Society? Can we see a direct line to the development of the apparatus that they talked about?
I mean, I think it's most of the time not that helpful to try to understand history in terms of sort of blueprints that were drawn up at a certain point that then sort of have come into realization over time. I think it's, I mean, the thing that I find interesting and helpful about returning to these intellectual discussions is to say, you know, what were they really most concerned with? You know, what were they, and what were they most scared of? And how did they propose to remedy that? And there, I think that you see that the neoliberals actually had some of the same concerns as the people they were supposedly opposed to, the Keynesians and the Social Democrats. So you often hear this opposition of Hayek versus Keynes. There's even a famous YouTube hip hop battle, a rap battle between Hayek and Keynes on this. But neoliberals and Keynesians both kind of had this, in effect, the same concern, which is they don't want there to be a revolution. They don't want people to ask so much in terms of equality and social justice that the whole market system breaks down. So I think if you think about the problem of neoliberalism as, you know, how do we save capitalism from being overthrown effectively, then you can sort of draw a straight line, because I think that all of the fixes and tweaks that we see at the international level and the national level to keep capitalism on its feet are always still addressing that same problem. So it's not so much a question of saying, you know, they said we should have this sort of a voting structure at the IMF, and then voila, it came right into being. It's more like the core problem of government that keeps on recurring.
When we're talking about basically the post World War II era, I guess, did Keynesians, Social Democrats, and the neoliberals that had gathered at Mont Pelerin, did they all agreed that the idea was, how do we maintain the capitalism, essentially, and sort of the some type of, if not status quo, I guess some type of stability? Is that the challenge there? I mean, just to be clear on where all three of those philosophies were headed.
Yeah, I mean, I think they were different solutions to the problem of how do we prevent people from destroying the system that they believe sustained well-being and order, i.e. the capitalist system. But to say that they were all defending capitalism doesn't really actually say that much, because I subscribe to the idea that there are many varieties of capitalism. And so when we have a welfare state, for example, that believes in the idea of some level of redistribution of wealth, you know, high taxes on the wealthy and social services like healthcare and education and Social Security, that's a form of capitalism. And Keynesians, I think, after the war said, we need this kind of a capitalism to ensure social peace, stability, and order. The neoliberals looked at that and said, no, the moment that we begin to make the promises inherent in the welfare state, the moment we start to give an inch and say, maybe we can have a bit of equality, we can have a bit of social justice, then people are going to kick open that door, and we're going to be marching towards full socialism before long. So if we want stability and order in the long run, we need to make sure that we don't make those kind of promises. So they were both dealing with, again, the same problem of how do we keep capitalism on its feet, but the remedy that the Social Democrats arrived at was seen as the slippery slope, right, in Hayek's famous metaphor to serfdom. If people were allowed to believe that there might be equality in the long run within capitalism, that was the most dangerous promise that was being made after the war in the minds of the neoliberals.
So one is let some air out of the tire, and the other one is, you know, be careful, you give a guy an inch and they think they're a ruler type of situation.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the problem of democracy is, you know, that the masses think they know what's best for them, but they actually tend to want things that are destructive in the long run. This is the neoliberal perspective.
I want to pursue obviously the new, but just so that people really get a sense of where things compare and contrast from a Keynesian perspective. Is there a similar anti-democratic strain, or how did their perspective on democracy play into this?
I mean, I think there definitely is, in the sense that once you come to a conclusion like, okay, we can preserve social order and stability as long as there is growth, let's say, right? And then you say, And there are certain economists and certain economic advisors and certain people in the government who know how to achieve growth better than the people do, then you begin to produce a kind of a system of a technocracy that insulates certain decisions from representative governments sort of meddling. So, for example, in the United States, trade policy is sort of hived off to the executive, right?
It's, right.
There's a lot of power given to the executive, and it's not often something that's decided upon by Congress. So decisions like that are sort of anti-democratic, if you want to put it that way, but they are also Keynesian and social democratic because their long-term goal is producing growth and some level, supposedly, of social equality. The neoliberal perspective is often again, an attempt to sort of insulate the rulemaking apparatus from democratic decisions, but not in the goal of growth, but in the goal of preserving a kind of a balance between property and sovereignty in a way that they think will ensure order in the long run, but sometimes will be premised on inequality in the short and long run as well.
And this is one of the, I guess, I don't know. We spoke to Philip Murawski about his book some time ago, and I think mm-hmm. it was certainly a misconception I had of neoliberal thought was that it was laissez-faire, but in fact, it's mm-hmm. really it's not. It's just a very specific very specific actions that need to be taken in support of very narrow interests, I guess. Mm-hmm. So, all right. So before we get into their perspective and their role in the international order, what was their prescription or thoughts about what needed to take place domestically in the countries where they had the most interest, I guess?
Well, the story that I tell in my book begins in 1920s Vienna, because that was the place that the kind of intellectual patriarch of the neoliberal movement, Ludwig von Mises, was based, and where he kind of created this school of protégés, including Hayek and Haberler and Machlup. And their problem was how to deal with the dissolution of the Habsburg Empire. So, you know, until the end of the First World War, Vienna was the center of a fairly large land-based territorial empire in the middle of Central Europe. And people like Mises were being trained to legislate and to sort of administer as civil servants the space of the empire. So after the war, suddenly Austria is this little mini mutilated corpse, as it was often called at the time. And the relationships with the former parts of the empire aren't very good. And so their real problem is, how can this state, which is now a small state, it was once a big state, be viable given the realities of the economic globalization that had been a reality in the end of the 19th century and was becoming again a reality. So how can Austrian exports compete? And the answer was, well, we need to make sure that we're not making undue promises to our workers. So even though there's a very strong socialist sentiment, the feeling was, how do we cut unemployment benefits? How do we break the right of unions to strike? And Mises was directly involved with advising the government on things like this, creating what was called an anti-terror law that would prohibit trade unions from striking. And the argument was used again and again was, we don't want to do this. It's not because we dislike the workers, but competition from other countries, export competition is so strong, and the world economy is effectively forcing us to do this. So our hands are tied. We need to do it to remain competitive. It might sound familiar, right? I mean, it's
right.
I think the kind of thing.
Donald Trump said on the campaign trail that wages were too high. And I mean, there's also been a huge, I guess, body of experience where that concept, Alan Greenspan, right, said his one job, I think, was to make sure that there's a certain amount of anxiety amongst workers on some level.
Mm-hmm. In the first pages of my book, I quote Alan Greenspan saying, I think it was in 2007, that it hardly matters who is elected president anymore because the decisions that we are forced to make are being made by the world economy, right? So this kind of outsourcing of responsibility to this entity called the world economy is not something that is only new in the 1990s, and let alone the post-2008 moment, but it's been a kind of a refrain for the last 120 years. There's a classic moment from Mises as well in 1908 where he says, well, and he's worried about Asian competition. He's actually worried about Chinese production. And he says, it may be the case that the conditions of the Austrian worker will have to sink to the level of the quote-unquote Hindu or the coolie for us to remain competitive. So this is exactly what Trump is saying about the need to, you know, remain competitive with China. We can't have the kind of wage structures and security benefits that the unions had long promised to workers.
And what was the primary argument within the context of those of thought that was looking to preserve a capitalist system? Was there a counter argument to that from those who are looking to preserve capitalism?
Well, I mean, I think that one thing that I find personally quite important to understand when you want to get your head around neoliberalism, and I think that Philip Murawski, who I've worked with, I'm co-editing a book with, who would agree with this, and it's, I think, his method too, is it's just not enough to see it as a kind of neoliberalism as a kind of a form of Satanism or just cruelty for its own sake, right? I mean, there's a tendency to make sense of it as simply sadistic. And if you look at it historically, I mean, you look at Mises and Hayek, right, both Austrians. If they're sitting there in 1945, they've seen two wars tear apart their homelands, right? I mean, their homes, and they've seen, Mises was Jewish. He's seen relatives, you know, murdered in the Holocaust. So they, when they say defending capitalism, if they ever use the word, which is rarely, they see it as an antidote to mass violence, right? I mean, it's not just that they want to preserve the status quo and make the rich richer. They believe quite sincerely, as many other people do, that free exchange and free trade and free capital movement is a guarantee of a degree of peace between states that has never been improved on. Right? So I think, I think that's an important context. And I think that a lot of, you know, people who would profess neoliberal ideas now would defend what would seem like their cruelty by simply pointing to the lessons of history and say, and with their own spin on it, you know, their belief is that the First World War and the Second World War were caused by economic nationalism, an opposition to the idea of free trade and the free movement of people and the free movement of capital. So if we can only get those things, then maybe we would have we would not have suffered some of the worst calamities of the century.
I want to just return to my original question in a second about that,
mm-hmm.
as to whether or not, I mean, so taking, stipulating that the neoliberals were doing this for the best of reasons, and they perceived capitalism as anywhere on the spectrum of, you know, the best system or the best system to keep, you know, horrible things of at bay. What was the competition intellectually in that same project at that mm-hmm. time? Keynesian thought, was that the competition, and did it in any way push back against the only way to maintain this order is to perhaps diminish the labor standards for, you know, the population?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the primary kind of intellectual antagonist changed over time. So if you look at the 1920s, the sort of the beginning of the story that I recount and that most people would sort of see as the beginnings of intellectual beginnings of neoliberalism, the people they're fighting against in Vienna are full-blown communists. So, I mean, the most famous of which is Otto Neurath, who believed that all distribution and allocation of resources could be planned centrally, right? So there would be no market mechanism in practice at all, and the price mechanism would not be, people wouldn't be getting things because of the way that things were being priced. They would be simply, everything would be organized centrally. So that was the way that sort of Mises and Hayek cut their teeth in the 1920s and 30s, early 30s. When the Keynesians come in, and you can talk about the 1930s, but especially immediately after the war, it's a much less extreme version, right? I mean, the Keynesian model is, of course, is to incorporate the market and incorporate prices, but to use planning mechanisms and especially national income accounting, so to treat the national economy as something that you can look at from the outside and sort of understand probabilities about and sort of guess the way things are going with some level of certainty. So that idea of planning in the 1940s looks much different from the planning of the 1920s, which was, you know, was highly centralized. By the 1960s, and this is sort of one of the twists in my book that hasn't been written about so much until now, I think, is we see a real concern about the decolonizing world. So the world of Africa and Asia and the, you know, long post-colonial countries of Latin America, the third world, or what we now call the global south, is being really active in the 1960s and 70s in places like the UN, saying, you know, this is an unjust system. We have been exploited because of colonialism. For there to be world stability and not just social stability inside each nation, we need to sort of redistribute resources somehow. We need to have a common program, et cetera, et cetera. The most full scale of this is called the New International Economic Order, which was passed by the UN General Assembly in 1974. And it was, as it was called at the time, a plan for a kind of welfare world, right? Not just a welfare state, but a welfare world. And this then really alarmed some of the neoliberal intellectuals, because they saw this as a way that the whole order of the global capitalist system would be undone. And the last part of my book is really describing the counter move against the demands from the third world that was being carried out in the 1980s and culminated really in the creation of the World Trade Organization. So I think that the scales change. I mean, there's a fear of a sort of a red Vienna in the 20s, and then the fear of a social democratic Western Europe and North America in the 60s, and then this fear of the welfare world sort of at the gunpoint, as they saw it, of the global south by the 70s. And those are all sort of ideas that seem quite fantastical now, right? I mean, yeah, I don't think many people sit around in Washington worried about the demands of the third world.
No, so, those days are gone. Exercise as much generosity as I can and accept your premise that there were benevolent impulses in the neoliberal perspective on why maintaining the specific type of capitalism that they wanted to maintain for the sake of keeping, you know, not having another situation where millions of people die. But where is that when you jump to the notion of this fear that, hey, we're going to want reparations for colonialism. We're going to want, a welfare world, if you will, where, mm-hmm. you know, the extraction of resources and the sort of the disadvantages colonial powers has put us in, we need to get paid for that. How it seems to me, I mean, at first blush, that like, okay, this is a stabilizing force, right? Like there is real concern, you know, there's anger and understandable. This is this is a stabilizing thing that will maintain sort of the status quo. What was their fear that was coming out of this, and how would it disrupt what they saw? How would mm-hmm. it, how does it fit into that paradigm of them like, we don't want another world war?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that part of it is it's important to sort of see it not as a benevolent impulse, because I mean, I think as I've described it before and other people have described it, like this liberalism in general, economic liberalism in the sort of European sense, which is like neoliberalism, sees itself as kind of the logic of the second worst, right? There's always something that is much worse, and that thing needs to be fended off. And so despite the pain and suffering that are produced, and they will be the first to admit it, by free markets, and the inequalities that are not going anywhere and will never go anywhere, the alternative is worse. And how do they come to that conclusion? Or how do they see the world that way? So use the example of the 1970s and the demands coming from the countries of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. What they see is they, taking this kind of system perspective, which they did, right? They see the world economy as this kind of cybernetic structure where there are signals flying around, and if there's something it's obstructed, right, if people are stopping capital moving from point A to point B, it creates this kind of clot in the system. And if there's a clot in the system, then that will sort of produce more and more system failures over time, and eventually the whole thing will fall apart. I mean, that's the sort of quick and dirty metaphorical way of describing it. They have a whole list of reasons how the demands of the global South had been conceded to in certain ways by the United States and Europe in the 1960s by giving them exceptions, let's say, from the world trading system. So saying, well, you don't have to drop your tariffs in exactly the same way that we do, because we've accepted that you're a developing country and you do get certain kinds of preferences. I mean, these things were actually very minor, and they were never going to come close to, you know, producing any level of equality. But to the neoliberal mind, they saw these things as kind of the first steps towards a world of segmented, mutually antagonistic, warring economic units that would end again in the kind of land grabbing and militarized foreign policy of the Second World War, right? So there's this constant fear that granting anyone an exception will produce this sort of knock-on effect and this sort of snowball effect. It's kind of like an economic version of the domino theory, right? Which we're much more familiar with from kind of Cold War thinking. I mean, imagine it like that, right? It's the economic version of the domino theory, which is that if Mozambique goes, right, and gets its own sort of exception on its agricultural products, then what happens to the neighboring country? They're going to ask for it too. Before you know it, the small countries in Europe are going to want some special treatment. So there's this kind of a fear of needing to constantly police at the margins. And if you know, I'm sitting here in Germany, there's been a very clear case of this in the headlines in the last decade, which is the German treatment of Greece.
Right.
Like the way that Greece was treated in the Eurozone crisis was beyond sort of all proportionality, right? I mean, they were being kind of punished for things that if you looked at internally were not even rational. I mean, the idea that it was somehow the German or the Greek scofflaw, you know, tax dodger that was the root of all the problems is just like dissolves upon any like close inspection.
Right.
But from the German point of view, we need to make sure that Greece acts as a kind of example to discipline the others, right?
But is this
so
like
that mentality follows?
When they look at the international order, is it a question of physics or is it a question of like morality, right? I mean, because it's like it all gets framed in this sort of like moral hazard language that will create this slippery slope. And then the idea is that, well, once you go down a certain part of the slippery slope, the sort of like semi-mystical physics that exists is going to fall apart. Is that the idea?
I mean, it depends which particular thinker you're looking at, but for example, Hayek was a very kind of trippy, mystical thinker, actually, which anyone who checks out some of his writings will discover pretty fast. He used sort of analogies for the economy that range from the neurons of the human mind all the way up to the stars of the cosmos. So he saw the world economy as just sort of one version of this kind of order. And that order was most of the time, right, in nature, it doesn't need external intervention to be maintained, because nature is, you know, it produces its own kind of internal harmony of sorts. But humans being humans, and having this kind of tendency towards self-destruction, there's a need for an outside kind of hand to preserve the conditions under which people will act in the ways that are best for themselves.
So the market existed in nature, and we were, you know, fortunate enough to stumble upon it.
In a way, yeah. I mean, the market is one of many kinds of orders, but humans, because of our naive ideas about creating things like justice and equality, tend to always be messing up the natural order. So, for example, he draws on some very idiosyncratic ideas of evolutionary psychology to say that our desire for social justice, and I think that's, I keep on repeating that term, because I think if you want to know what the neoliberals are opposed to, it's the idea of social justice. It's that's the central target. And
because bad things are, you know, if we try and mess with the natural order of things, you know, bad things happen, right? Is that
we will break that? We will break the mechanism. Yeah, we will crack the function of the thing that is keeping us all alive.
I mean,
and this is literally the way Hayek sees it.
Not being a historian and not being an academic, I think I have a little more license to say things like this. But we've also just described, like, Dianetics, right? I mean, like, if you make any decisions outside of what we have deemed is the natural order of things, bad things will happen. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
I don't know enough about Dianetics to know if that's I could check it out more. But yeah, I mean, it's effectively the devil's bargain between democracy and capitalism, according to the way that the neoliberals see it, things. Right. Which is that democracy is actually very helpful. It is the most effective way of producing social peace that has been ever discovered by humans, that the transition of power tends to happen more or less smoothly, more or less without war, when you compare it to any other form of system of political system that preceded it. But putting that kind of power in the hands of people who actually don't have the time or the reason to think carefully, right, in the way that they would see it, about the decisions they're making, is like just putting like a bazooka in the hands of like a 2-year-old, right? I mean, that's the way they see it. And like the threat that they're just going to blow the whole thing up is like ever present. So you need, and this is the way that Hayek, for example, when he was reflecting on why he formed the Mont Pelerin Society, he said, I formed an international association with like-minded people who are interested in placing constitutional constraints on democratic government. I mean, this is his description of neoliberalism, is, you know, how do we have democracy, but without having it interfere too much with the things that we need or know are necessary to keep the market alive.
And just to be clear, when he's saying constitutional, he's talking about almost like the natural order of things, not he's talking about the essence of like human, I guess, involvement, as opposed to a document.
Well, he's talking about both. Yeah. No, I mean, it's a good question. And in fact, indeed, the German neoliberals did use constitution in this sort of grander way, like as in like the health of the body, our constitution. So how do you produce this kind of state of affairs? But I mean, Hayek wrote detailed paper style constitutions that he suggested might be put into place, right? I mean, this is one of the great ironies to me of the circulating cliche that neoliberals somehow are anti-state or don't believe in governments or don't believe in the state. I mean, all Hayek did was write these kind of like detailed blueprints for states. I mean, this is his entire intellectual production for the last 50 years of his life. James Buchanan, about whom much has been written recently, is similar. I mean, Milton Friedman, his book Free to Choose begins with this sort of like paean to the magic of the market, but the last chapter is an economic bill of rights with a list of things like a balanced budget amendment, certain things, the need for supermajorities to pass new forms of raising revenue. So it's always been about redesigning the state. It's never been about somehow making the state vanish. I think that, you know, people who repeat that notion are actually playing into the hands of neoliberal thinkers themselves, because they're buying that misleading cliche.
Right, that they're not just developing a mechanism for the state. And also, I mean, the thesis of your book is that they're developing a mechanism to maintain this order, that they're mm-hmm. looking to institutions and whatnot to protect the status quo and to prevent nationalism on an international scale from interfering into it. And I mean, that to me is like when we talk about the notion of these international dispute, these corporate dispute boards in like mm-hmm, NAFTA mm-hmm. and in right. The
investor state dispute.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, that's really like that's what they were hoping for. Right. I mean, to maintain this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, what you describe is exactly right, as sort of the point of my book, which is to say, to turn this cliche on its head that since the 90s and before then, we've had a sort of a liberation or a freeing or an unfettering of world markets. But that same period of time has seen like a huge proliferation of all kinds of trade treaties, of third party arbitration tribunals, of investor protection agreements. So I argue that actually markets have been encased because they're actually being legally, you know, prevented from being interfered with by democratic states more than anything. And what you're describing, I think, is indeed an expression of that. But, and I think this is a hugely important caveat, especially at our present moment, is I think that the idea of, let's say, producing a third-party tribunal whereby the United States could, you know, sue a Chinese company in a third court. The politics inherent in that are not predetermined, right? Like, I think you could actually have progressive outcomes from things like supranational trade treaties, even third party trade agreements, right? I mean, you could be using those, you could be using something like the WTO more like the International Labor Organization to say this thing is created to protect labor standards, environmental standards, right?
Of course.
But it bears repeating, because I feel like a lot of the sort of critique right now of supranational institutions is like shading towards this thing of sort of dismissing all of them as a neoliberal plot, which then leaves us kind of stuck with just nations, right? So I think it's important to sort of see these things as open to reclamation and re-engineering and reinvention, and not simply just, you know, a nefarious plot designed to like strip us of our sovereignty or whatever.
Right. Well, but ultimately, right, the point is that neoliberals are not looking. They would agree with the idea that there's really the market doesn't exist on its own, because they are looking for a governmental, and if not governmental, you know, quasi-governmental entities that will mm-hmm. make sure that the market functions in the way they think it should function.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
the fact that these entities could make the market function in a different way is mm-hmm. indication that these are all just political choices.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the way that since the 1920s, many of these people that we're talking about have described what their goal is what they called depoliticization, right? That's the word that has been used since the 30s to describe what the goal was. And that's a way to protect the economy. If you can depoliticize trade, I mean, it is obvious. It doesn't even need to be pointed out that to depoliticize something is itself a political choice. But I think that what we're seeing now is this moment where people are kind of wising up to depoliticization. Unfortunately, from my perspective, I assume from yours too, the people who are, you know, most effectively challenging depoliticization right now are doing it from the right.
Right.
So I think what we're finding now is like to point out depoliticization is essential, but it's only the beginning. Because once you've pointed it out, then you need to have the argument about what kind of politics you want to replace that depoliticization.
And I mean, what's interesting is that, I mean, because you also write about how there is not such a chasm between nativism and that being like a right-wing populist movements and this neoliberal thought. Mm-hmm. And for me, like the idea of depoliticization about what is clearly a political choice to maintain a system that just coincidentally also mm-hmm. is beneficial to the espousers of this system. Like it's just, you know, just happens to be where we are. And mm-hmm. So, you know, that's what the natural thing is very much reminiscent of, and he's been on my mind too much lately, so I apologize, but like a Jordan Peterson saying that anything that deviates from his experience as a white male is mm-hmm. is political or is mm-hmm. identitarian or whatever it is. That mm-hmm. the baseline is white malehood, and mm-hmm. anything else is politicization or is something active, as opposed to just sort of like the comfortable stasis where we are, where, you know, it just so happens we're on top.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that, of course, that is part of the story, which is just this like false universalism, which is actually just a different kind of particularity or particularism. But I think, I mean, the way that someone like Hayek approaches it, I think, is a little bit more self-aware, actually, which is to say, I don't think he's just sort of self-reflexively, you know, writing apologies for capitalism and not realizing it. I think that, I mean, what he sees is that politics can have the tendency to spring up everywhere. I mean, anyone who had been in Vienna in the 1920s would know that intimately, right? And so because they have the capacity to spring up everywhere, what you need is a system that is doing the allocation and distribution of wealth and producing life chances for all of us that is as faceless as possible, right? I mean, this is actually the miracle of the market from Hayek's point of view, ultimately, is it provides no enemy. No identifiable, you know, bastille to storm, no king to decapitate. The market, because it seems to be sort of everywhere and is part of our everyday interactions, becomes something that we're both part of and we can't escape, and we wouldn't even know how to kill if we wanted to, right? So that is, I think, a more refined version of the kind of blind universalism argument. I think it's, you know, it's not just that that coincidentally, you know, the world corresponds in its best and just form with the way that is in his or people like his best interest. It's that this is a consciously thought through notion of how order can best be reproduced. And of course, that doesn't mean that he was sort of personally responsible for all this, but I think it's actually it's an illuminating way to think about the problem that we're confronted with politically.
Quinn Slobodan, the book is Globalists, the End of Empire and the Birth of Neoliberalism. We'll put a link to that at majorityreportradio.com. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for the conversation. It was great. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb, but finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my power.
get somewhere the choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid. For the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somewhere I lost my drive. Between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. The months shifted into years, while I shifted into